From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jeffrey Epstein's death has complicated the cases against him, but one accuser, Jennifer Arose, is going forward with a lawsuit against his estate, his longtime confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell, and three other unidentified women who worked for him. Jennifer Arose says she was sexually abused and raped by Jeffrey Epstein when she was a teenager. Here she is on a conference call with lawyers and reporters.
Jeffrey Epstein and his network of enablers stole from me. They robbed me of my youth, my identity, my innocence, and my self-worth. For too long, they escaped accountability. I am here today because I intend to change that.
And for the latest on this chapter in the Epstein story, we're joined by NPR's Sasha Ingber. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, in July, this young woman said she planned a criminal and civil suit. Now, of course, it's just a civil suit because he's died. Tell us more about it.
Sure. Well, today she said that she was reclaiming power starting today. And the lawsuit goes after Ghislaine Maxwell, as you say, and three unnamed women, a recruiter, a secretary, and a maid. It specifically says that Maxwell played a key role in the trafficking ring. The document says that she scheduled appointments, that she essentially helped to ensure that three girls consistently would show up every day at Epstein's residence. Her lawyer, Dan Kaiser, said today that she was a co-conspirator in the trafficking ring. Mm. And so it's very serious, and we're going to see what happens.
Right. And it may be the first time we see Maxwell, because we know back in 2008 she made a deposition when Epstein was on trial in Florida, denying allegations that she procured children, underage girls, for Epstein. But now she's been elusive. I don't even think she's been in public. Do we even know where she is?
That's a really good question, Robin. We don't know where she is. And the lawyers said that as well today. They did mention that they were in contact with a criminal defense lawyer for her. So there has been some communication, but her whereabouts are really unknown.
Yeah. Well, Attorney General Bill Barr said that Epstein's co-conspirators should not rest easy. This woman is accusing Maxwell of being one of them. How are prosecutors approaching this case overall after Epstein's death?
Well, the question now that Epstein is dead is who enabled him? Who is there pushing him forward and allowing so many alleged victims to be victimized? One of Arose's lawyers said that there were wealthy and powerful people specifically who enabled him. Those people were not named specifically. U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, he promised that the case would continue against anyone who was complicit. And he said that they shouldn't rest easy, as you mentioned, that victims deserve justice and that they'll get it.
Yeah.
Earlier this week, the FBI raided Epstein's home on a private island in the Caribbean. They were looking for more evidence at that time.
Yeah. The attorney general also reassigned the warden at the prison where Epstein died, reportedly at his own hand. Two more staff members were placed on administrative leave. Well, you know, what more do we know about what was happening, what was supposed to be happening, and what was actually happening when Epstein died?
Well, it's important to remember that Epstein appeared to have tried to take his own life before Saturday when he was found unresponsive. And he had been put on special observation status where he would be with a cellmate and he would receive check-ins from staff every 30 minutes. But that didn't happen. Bill Barr said that the investigators found serious irregularities at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, and he blamed the prison for failing to adequately secure Epstein. There are a number of investigations into Epstein's death, including one by the House Judiciary Committee. It said that his death showed deficiencies in the inmate protocol. So there's a lot more to come.
Yeah, and we will follow this story with NPR's Sasha Ingberg. Sasha, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, in Hong Kong today, the international airport is open and flights are arriving and departing after several days of disruptions caused by pro-democracy protesters. The protests erupted into chaos yesterday. Joining us now is CNN senior international correspondent Ivan Watson in Hong Kong. Hi, Ivan.
Hey there, Jeremy.
And it seems like things have calmed down significantly at the airport today.
Yeah, I think that the violent scenes that we saw there Tuesday night, where I literally saw this Chinese state news outlet reporter on the verge of being lynched until he was finally spirited away by first aid workers, I think there's a kind of collective shame on the part of some of the opposition about how out of control things got. And I also think the authorities, both Hong Kong Airport Authority and the Hong Kong administration, have taken additional measures to try to ensure that you don't have repeats of the chaos that we've seen at the airport the past couple of days.
Well, in fact, there was a photograph that's circulating today that shows some protesters holding a sign at the airport that reads, "Dear tourists, we're deeply sorry about what happened yesterday. We were desperate and we made imperfect decisions. Please accept our apology."
Yeah, and that's striking because while the protesters Monday and Tuesday night were physically preventing people from being able to fly out of the city as part of their campaign of civil disobedience, they were justifying it, saying, "Hey, we're sorry for the inconvenience, but we're fighting for our freedom." But they were stranding tens of thousands of people who have nothing to do with the political crisis. But I think that there is an admission that the opposition here lost the moral high ground when they prevented two men that they had detained from receiving medical care while they were being beaten.
What is the demand of the protesters at this point? They've already gotten this extradition law that they were opposed to, which would have allowed Hong Kong to send criminal suspects to mainland China for trial. That's been suspended. What is it that they want now?
Well, they want it to go a step further. They want it completely removed. And that's something that the Hong Kong authorities are not willing to do. They've kind of played semantics, said it's killed, but it could still be revived. Their other demands are for an impartial investigation into allegations of excessive use of police force. They want demonstrators who've been arrested to all be released. They want to change the legal status of the protests from being called riots to something softer. And I've spoken with a senior government official here in the Hong Kong administration who has made it clear that there will be no compromises on the five demands that the protesters have put forward.
Well, and in fact, the Chinese, as we've been reporting, have been putting troops at the border with Hong Kong.
Yeah, the Chinese government has been saber-rattling, saying that the behavior of the protesters is borderline terrorism now, and putting out videos of security forces kind of conducting maneuvers very close to Hong Kong, clearly in an effort to intimidate the opposition here.
President Trump talked about what's going on yesterday. He said the Hong Kong thing is a very tough situation, very tough. We'll see what happens, but I'm sure it'll work out. I hope it works out for everybody, including China, by the way. Some people, even conservatives, have been upset that he hasn't taken a stronger stand with the protesters, some of whom have been carrying American flags.
Yeah, that's been a remarkable image, and it feeds into a narrative that has been promoted by some of the Chinese state media outlets that these protests are, in fact, the work of kind of dastardly Western forces and intelligence agencies. And I've met Hong Kongers who've said, "Hey, I think they're all being paid by the CIA or by the U.S. to do this." I've seen no evidence to back that up. A senior Hong Kong government official has said he has seen no evidence to back that up either. But certainly the optics of protesters carrying around American flags or British flags feeds into that kind of conspiracy theory that this is all the work of the U.S. or Britain, the former colonial ruler of Hong Kong.
You know, Ivan, for our listeners who have not been to Hong Kong, it's sort of like New York or London. It's a huge city, a very modern city. A lot of people there speak English. It's a financial center. Is all of that at risk in this, do you think?
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is, without question, the freest city in modern-day China. And that's through a twist of colonial history that the draconian censorship in China isn't applied here. It has more freedoms. And the protesters here want to protect them. And one of the concerns is that there could be a backlash and China could whittle away further at the freedoms that this place enjoys and could further sideline Hong Kong as a comfortable hub for international finance and transit and business. And its traditional position that goes back to British colonial times as being this gateway into China.
Ivan, where do you see this heading at this point?
You know, I've predicted this wrong every step of the way, Jeremy. So I am loath to make a prediction. I'm struck when I see how angry not just these protesters are against the police, but also ordinary residents. After their neighborhoods get tear gassed, they come out and hurl abuse at the police. And Hong Kong risks having a lost generation after this because of the arrest of hundreds and hundreds of young people.
That is CNN's senior international correspondent Ivan Watson in Hong Kong. Ivan, thanks.
Happy to talk to you.
And some developments today. The U.S. State Department has issued a travel advisory for Hong Kong, urging increased caution in Hong Kong due to civil unrest. And the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross gave an interview to CNBC today and was pressed on President Trump appearing to be neutral on the Hong Kong situation. Ross called the dispute between Hong Kong and China an internal matter. This year marks 100 years since the Grand Canyon became a national park, and all this week we're talking about the canyon, about its geology and how it was created over millions of years. We talked about the Native Americans who've lived in the canyon for centuries, and today we're going to look at the challenges the canyon faces now with Jan Balsam, who is senior advisor to the superintendent at the Grand Canyon National Park. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start by asking you, I mean, obviously the Grand Canyon has been around a lot longer than 100 years, but how has the park changed since it was first designated a national park in 1919?
So the Grand Canyon itself has changed very little in the last 100 years, but the facilities in the park, visitation in the park, all of those things have changed a lot. From the early days when you could only reach the canyon by foot or by horse or mule, stagecoach, then train, then automobile. So our visitation has gradually increased over time from a few thousand hardy individuals to the 6.3 million that we hosted this past year.
6.3 million people. And where are they coming from?
Our visitation is worldwide. We are a World Heritage Site as well. So that increases our visibility internationally as well as nationally. So certainly a lot of our visitors are local Arizonans. This is the Grand Canyon State. But folks on summer vacation, a lot of international visitors, especially off-season when they have different travel schedules. So really it's an international destination.
And what about for Americans? Do you see the racial diversity of this country? Or we've heard in other national parks that there are lower numbers of, for example, African Americans visiting the park than white Americans.
Yeah, I think, we look at trying to expand our programming and our offerings to the diversity that is America and try to have our staff reflect the diversity that's America. But we are kind of isolated here in northern Arizona. And being not close to an urban center, I think that you tend to have more visitors on vacations who are more used to sort of the camping national park experience than you do the urban experiences.
Mm-hmm. How often do you have to go in and do a rescue because somebody's gotten into trouble in the Grand Canyon?
You know, it varies, especially this time of year where it's really hot. We've got a number of, folks who overextend themselves. So it's kind of hard. We also have preventative search and rescue rangers on site who are hiking the trails to try to alleviate some of the rescues that could potentially happen by being on the trails, helping people out early, getting them water, getting them salty snacks. I don't have a number, but we certainly are vigilant in terms of trying to educate folks before they go on a hike to be properly hydrated, to have the right hiking materials with them, to have hiking sticks, to have salty snacks and water, and not to hike during the heat of the day.
And do you find that visitors generally take good care of the park, don't leave trash behind, et cetera?
I think that, again, it's an education thing, and we always find trash over the rims. And I'm going to say that when the winds pick up, it's hard to hold on to sometimes your wrappers, but folks are pretty good about it. We do a lot, again, of education about leave no trace and cleaning up after yourself. But with 6.3 million people, there will be trash that needs to get picked up.
What would be your one piece of advice to visitors just to try to make that situation better?
I think treat it as you would your home. And it is a resource that belongs to all of us.
As you mentioned, there are a number of different tribes that are traditionally associated with the Grand Canyon. Tell us a little bit about their relationships with the canyon historically and today.
So Grand Canyon National Park maintains government-to-government relationships with 11 separate tribal governments. And each one of the tribes has ancestral history in the canyon that started, for the most part, time immemorial, the beginnings of time. It goes through our present day. The Havasupai, the Hopi, the Hualapai, the Navajo, the Zuni, White Mountain Apache, Yavapai Apache, a number of different southern Paiute bands. So altogether, there's 11, and we actively work with each and every one of them on different areas that they are interested in, because we are stewards today, but they've been stewards for all time.
Jan Balsam, I want to ask you, as you look forward, what do you think the next 100 years at the Grand Canyon will bring?
You know, we've spent a lot of time in the last year talking about the past 100, and we really do want to focus on the next 100. You know, places like Grand Canyon are important to all of us, but it takes each and every one of us to care about stewarding places for the future and seeing themselves as a guardian of the canyon. The Havasupai people refer to themselves as the guardians, and I think in many ways we all have a responsibility for these special places. So what I see is more engagement, more diversity. We're working with our tribal partners on a number of programs to bring our Desert View area of the park as intertribal cultural heritage sites, bring it to it as a living landscape to allow our visitors to interact with tribal peoples, to look at youth as part of our future, and really look at how do we go about preserving these landscapes, the physical landscapes, but also our night skies and our water resources and all of those other components that make the ecosystem alive. Keep it for the next 100 and for the next 100 after that, the next 100 after that. As Teddy Roosevelt has said, for your children and your children's children.
How concerned are you about climate change and its effect on the park?
You know, climate change is one of those things that we're all experiencing in different ways. I mean, the Grand Canyon is in the Upper Sonoran Desert. It is a fragile environment to begin with. And I think we're seeing some of the changes in the vegetation patterns and our water patterns. And we can't change it, but we need to be able to adapt to it.
What about mining? Does that have an impact on the park?
Mining has been a part of our history for the last 100 years, from the early days where they thought, you see all this rock, it's obviously a great place to find riches, only to find out that there was a little bit of copper, some bat guano and asbestos, and more recently uranium. And there are no active mines in the park. There certainly are mining operations on our boundaries, and we are concerned about the effects of the groundwater system in particular, because no one has a very good understanding of what happens when you start sinking wells into the ground and tap into those aquifers as to where that water goes. So that is something that we pay attention to, and we're hopeful that the mining operations are environmentally sensitive and understand sort of the broader picture of the plateau and the environmental effects to those, all of those resources.
What kind of wildlife is there in the Grand Canyon?
You've got a lot of squirrels. By golly, a lot of squirrels that like to get up into your pack and unzip it and get your snack. So you have to be vigilant about that.
I remember going to the Angel's Landing Trail at Zion National Park, and I wouldn't go onto the part that a lot of people do that's looks kind of scary, like on the side of a rock, very high up, because of the squirrels. And they said, be careful, the squirrels will bite you.
Yeah, our biggest threat to visitors in the park are squirrels.
Wow.
So ravens, obviously we have bighorn sheep. Our native fish population is the healthiest in the entire Colorado River system. The elk that you see on the South Rim are not native to the area. They were introduced in the early teens. A lot of mule deer, though, that you'll see up on the rim as well. Kind of the complement that you'll see in the Upper Sonoran Desert and in the mountain areas of Arizona. We are lucky enough to have California condors that were released, and we have a fairly healthy population for an endangered species. So on any given day, you may well see something that looks almost like a small airplane, and it's actually a California condor that's flying above. So it's really a treat to see some of the birds, bats, the mule deer in particular, and the bighorn sheep, if you're lucky enough to see them, bobcats, mountain lions. They're elusive, but they're there. Coyotes.
Now, most visitors look at the canyon from the rim. How is the experience different when you actually hike to the bottom of the canyon or raft on the Colorado River that runs through it?
So the experience is very different, and I just got off a 10-day river trip on Friday.
Lucky
so
you. Wow.
It was great, and actually a number of our tribal colleagues were on the river with me talking about some of the very things that we've been talking about in terms of what the future is going to look like. even a short walk below the rim, 5 minutes down a trail, you realize just how much time elapses, how a five-minute walk will put you in the Kaibab limestone, which is, you know, 400 million-year-old rocks. So it's the issue of deep time, and also as you walk down, you leave the upper elevation, the coolness of the ponderosa pine forests, pinyon dune forests, as you go down into the lower Sonoran cactus deserts of the river corridor. Each elevation has its own uniqueness to it and its own plant and animal life as well.
What is your favorite thing about the Grand Canyon?
You know, it's I've lived at the canyon for over 30 years, and each and every day that I'm there, I walk the rim just to look at this immense landscape. I love the early morning. I love the twilight time where the sun is setting. I love the night skies, the smell of the vegetation after a rain. And I love being on the river where you can, you know, really, the tribes say it's the backbone or the lifeblood of the canyon. And I think each and every piece of the canyon offers something different to someone. So the human history goes back over 10,000 years. The canyon itself, you know, the rocks are 1.8 billion years old. So it's deep time, it's recent time, it's human history, it's Earth's history. So there's not just one thing. It's a whole package for me.
That is Jan Balsam, who's a senior advisor to the superintendent at the Grand Canyon National Park, which is 100 years old this year. Jan Balsam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're, of course, following the investigation into the mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio. The friend of the shooter, who's admitted to buying body armor, a rifle part, and a 100-round magazine for the gunman, and to helping him keep it a secret from his family, is in court later today. His attorney says he didn't know what those things were going to be used for. Investigators have looked over surveillance videos and have a more detailed timeline of the shooter's movements, but still no motive. Will Garby with Dayton Daily News has been following this for us. And Will, first to the woman that police and her family have identified as the gunman's sister, Megan Betts, one of the nine killed. You say there's a division among police over whether or not the shooter targeted her and the friend who came with the siblings to the bar area?
Yeah, the reason being, one, it happened so fast that there are some homicide detectives who say, look, there is no way he would have been able to, in the middle of the night, through a fence with a bunch of umbrellas, been able to see these two individuals kill one and wound the other. Other detectives are saying, well, absolutely. He knew where they were. He knew that they had talked with each other on the phone when Connor, the shooter, had separated from them. So there really is a considerable disagreement between them. And the chief said it's likely inconclusive unless the FBI, who's doing the background investigation into the shooter, unless they're able to come up with something, the chief of police says it's unlikely that they'll be able to figure it out.
Well, what about the friend, Chase Beard, who went with the Betts siblings, you know, to the bar? We feel we haven't heard a lot. He did survive, thankfully. But what more do we know about what he knows?
Well, it's interesting. Police have said that there's no indication that this friend would have known that he would become the victim of a mass shooting when he went to the bar with his friend. Beyond that, police really haven't said much about him. They haven't even really said his name. I mean, the only reason we know the name is through our own reporting. They have simply called him the companion. And, you know, they haven't given many details about, who he is or why he was with the gunman at the time of the shooting, other than that he, from everything they can tell, didn't know that he was going to eventually become a wounded victim of this attack.
Yeah. And we said they don't know the gunman's motive. But it's interesting that Dayton's police chief said the mindset of the gunman was clear. How did he explain that?
So he drew a distinction between motivation and mindset. Motivation, he said, would speak to why the Oregon District, why the particular victims, why the night it happened. None of those things they've been able to come up with yet. The mindset, however, he said, is very clear. A progression toward violence, that's one of the things that the Dayton Daily News reported almost immediately after the shooting, was this idea that he had this hit list in high school. talked with others about mass shootings, something else that the Dayton Daily News reported right after the attack happened. And so the police chief really came out and said, look, based off of all of these things that you all know, there was a pretty obvious progression toward violence and interest in mass shootings. But the specifics of the shooting in the Oregon District itself and the motivation for that in that particular time, particular location, those things just still aren't clear.
Yeah. Will Garbey reported with the Dayton Daily News following the aftermath of that terrible shooting there. Will, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You may remember a couple weeks ago, I went to our resident chef Kathy Gunst's house in Maine to make some interesting pizzas with her. You can find those, including the delicious white clam pizza, at hereandnow.org. But while we were there, we also sampled some summer salads. Take a listen. Okay, Kathy, so we're here in the kitchen to make salads. I can't think of anything more refreshing in the middle of the summer than to have a delicious summer salad. But these, I can already tell, are going to be up a notch from anything that people are used to.
We always aim to go up a notch.
Exactly.
But these are main course salads. They all include a protein. And what's really fun about these salads is if you get all your ingredients ready, you throw the protein on the grill, and you sit down to dinner in about 10 or 15 minutes. So it's fast, it's satisfying. It also qualifies as true summer food because they tend to be very light, these salads, and they rely on all the best fresh summer produce.
Healthy?
Very healthy. You can substitute tofu or fish for the meat if that's the way you like to eat, but these are super simple, and I'll take you through my favorite one.
So let's talk about this one.
Okay, so this is a Vietnamese-inspired salad. And what we're going to do is I marinated pork. You could get a pork blade steak or a boneless pork chop. And I marinated it in fish sauce and chili paste, cilantro, mint, really like a bunch of wonderfully powerful ingredients. Mm-hmm. And you can marinate it for an hour or overnight. And then I throw it on a hot grill for 4 to 5 minutes per side, take it off the heat, let it sit so the juices settle. And in the meantime, here's what we've got. We've got a bowl of grated carrots. Mm-hmm. We've got a bowl of juicy bean sprouts. Mm-hmm. Then this is what's really flavorful.
Some mint.
Fresh mint, basil, two different kinds of basil. This is a Japanese basil, and then fresh cilantro leaves. So there's going to be an herb salad in the middle
Without the noodles and without the heat, right.
And it's cooling. And then wonderfully crunchy salted peanuts. Mm-hmm. So you can use a butter lettuce or any type of big leaf lettuce. And I'm going to ask you to make one.
Okay.
Because they're fun. They're almost like a fresh spring roll where the lettuce is the wrapper.
Okay.
So here's some pork.
Okay.
I'm going to
layer the
pork
on the lettuce.
In the middle. Yep. Here's another piece.
Okay.
Then take some carrots. And I'm going to put some sprouts on mine.
Okay.
Here's sprouts for you. So you see, you're building colors.
Don't want to make it too big.
No, because
like you're making a taco or something like that.
It's the same idea, but we're building colors, textures, flavors. Then I would add a fresh sprig of the basil and a fresh sprig of mint or part thereof.
Some cilantro,
and I'm going to put some salty, crunchy peanuts. Here you go.
Okay.
Peanuts. And then this sauce I am quite proud of.
That does look delicious.
Fish sauce, brown sugar, cilantro, mint, chili paste, and a little bit of water. Spoon a little bit
on top. There's no soy sauce in there, even though it looks
like there is. There is a little bit of soy sauce, yes.
Spoon a little bit of that on top of here.
And then you lift the lettuce leaf and kind of wrap it around the whole thing.
This is going to be
just like you would with a spring roll. This is summer messy eating. You know, just go for it. It's radio.
Okay.
No one can see your shirt getting stained. And then you get a bite of this crunch, right? You get the chili paste a little bit. You get the fish sauce and that fresh herbs. That's actually my favorite part of this dish, or the way that the fresh cilantro, mint, and basil plays off that grilled pork.
Yeah, this is not the kind of thing that I would even think of in the salad category, but it really is.
It really is.
Wrapped in a piece of lettuce.
Yeah, and you don't have to wrap it. You can lay some lettuce leaves on a beautiful plate and layer on the pork and all your vegetables and just serve it like that. But it's fun. It's like interactive eating.
How many of these would you have for a meal?
100?
But you could do 50 if that's all you can handle.
No, you probably would want to eat at least four of these. But there's quite a bit of protein in there. So a whole other take on this is this salad right here. So Niçoise salad is a very famous salad from the south of France.
Usually with tuna.
Exactly. Most people make it with canned tuna, which I absolutely love and is delicious. Mm-hmm. Or you can grill fresh tuna. I thought I would try something different. So I took boneless chicken thighs, mm-hmm. and I marinated them in olive oil, white wine, fresh thyme, lemon zest, and fresh ground pepper. Mm-hmm. Put the chicken thighs on the grill. They kind of got a beautiful caramelized brown. Then I cut them into big pieces. I have the first potatoes from my garden that I just lightly boiled until tender. String beans from the garden, yellow and green. I've got a not quite hard-boiled egg here where the yolk is solid but yummy and soft. Fresh tomatoes from the garden, pitted black olives, anchovies, a flavor I love, and then beautiful summer greens. And then I made a very simple vinaigrette with all the same flavors. Lemon juice, herbs, olive oil, pepper.
That looks delicious.
This is true main course eating. I mean, you've got protein, well, vegetable, salad, all in one.
It's sort of like a Cobb salad, but a Niçoise salad.
Yeah, because the flavors of a Niçoise salad are the olives and the anchovies. Mm-hmm. And then I took a few edible flowers from the garden, which are always very pretty.
Dressing it with that delicious-looking vinaigrette there.
Let me serve you some little bit of everything. I mean, this is a whole dinner.
How many times can I say in this segment, Kathy?
Well, let's see. What would be something? Best salad of my life might be good. All right, there you go. Let me give you some of the potatoes.
I'm going to try this artichoke heart, which is a great thing to put in a salad.
Yes, and I just really took that out of the bottle. I will come clean.
Best salad of my life. Best Niçoise.
How did you come up with that line?
I don't know.
It's really refreshing. It's sort of hearty and light all at the same time. And again, summer, summer, summer.
And this is on our website, hereandnow.org, as is one more salad that we're going to talk about right now, which is...
I know that there are a lot of people who think salad, that's not a dinner. Right? It's a side course. It's a lunch maybe, but that's, you know, particularly men, I think. They're like, I don't eat
that's
salad.
That's an appetizer.
That's a cliche.
If I'm on a diet, I'll have a salad as the main course.
But this is a main course dinner salad. I took a skirt steak, or you could use a hanger steak. I marinated it in red wine with a lot of garlic and fresh herbs. I grilled it for about 3 to 4 minutes per side. I thinly sliced it on the diagonal. I put it on beautiful peppery greens. There's arugula in there. There is some sorrel.
Some blue cheese.
Because blue cheese and steak, yum. Mm-hmm. And then a whole bunch of garden tomatoes. And that's a main course salad. So give that a taste.
Okay, let me try this right here.
And you can debunk the whole idea that salads for dinner are bogus.
Mm-hmm. Trying a piece of steak here with some blue cheese and tomato. Mm. Wow.
The meat is really flavorful with
that marinade. Would be a main course salad no matter what.
I agree. Can we talk about marinades for a minute? Because it's another thing that people think, oh, marinades, that's like a whole other step. I'm not going to do that. It's simply a matter of mixing 4 or 5 ingredients, throwing them over the protein. And again, if it just sat for an hour, it would definitely...
makes a difference.
It flavors the meat, but it also tenderizes it.
You know, Kathy, it's interesting. You've introduced me to a number of new salads here. I have salad with just about every meal that I have. My go-tos, which is either kind of a Greek salad of sorts, or just a simple spinach, tomato, avocado, maybe even a little bit of cucumber in there as well. But when you add all these things in, it really changes the game completely.
It does. And you could keep to your salads and just take chicken and marinate it for an hour and throw it on the grill and add it to the regular dinner salad you have. And then you don't need a main course. You're saving time. And these salads just make me feel good and energized. And I just love summer food so much that any excuse to focus on it and not have it be the side thing is a win-win.
Well, and especially when so many of the ingredients in these salads are coming from your own garden. You've grown this.
I have grown.
These are your babies.
These are my babies. The tomatoes are just starting, and they're going to be coming in for weeks if all goes well. And the greens are so delicious because each one has its own flavor profile. And then, you know, the cheese, the blue cheese in this case, adds like a pungency, but it's also creamy against the meat. So I always talk about this, but people forget about texture. The meat is chewy. The blue cheese is creamy. Mm-hmm. The tomatoes are juicy and fresh and acidic. And the fresh greens have a slight bite. And all together, you get this very pleasing bite.
Well, and in the case of the Vietnamese salad, a lot of crispy, crunchy texture as
well. Exactly, with those salty peanuts on it too. And colors. I mean, these salads, your eyes, the minute you sit down at the table, are going to say, I'm in.
We will have all of these recipes and photos of these beautiful salads at hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst in her own residence today. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thanks for being here, Jeremy.
After the massacres in El Paso and Dayton that took the lives of 31 people, President Trump said he supports so-called red flag laws to curb gun violence. These laws have already been adopted in 17 states and the District of Columbia. Most of them were passed after the 2018 Parkland school shooting. The specifics of them vary from state to state, but they allow family or police to appeal to a judge for a warrant to temporarily remove guns from someone who might be a danger to themselves or others. Well, one of the earliest states to adopt a red flag law was Indiana, which also allows police to seize guns if there's no time to appeal to a judge. Side Effect Public Media's Isaiah Seibert reports on a recent case in the state that highlights the complications of the law for people with mental health problems.
Earlier this year, police dispatchers in Evansville received a chilling call. A man said he was holding his wife at knife point and warned police that he was heavily armed.
I spent the last 2 days arguing my presence against police forced entry, and I'm armed at the teeth.
Despite him saying he had spent 2 days, quote, arming my residence in the event of forced police entry, the threat to his wife proved to be false, and the man was arrested for making an improper 911 call. But local newscasts reported that he did have a lot of guns.
Evansville police say they seized nearly a dozen guns from a mentally unstable man's home.
To do that, the newscast said, police invoked a state law called the law allows police to confiscate guns from people deemed dangerous to either themselves or others. Sam Preston has seen it used before. He worked at the county sheriff's office for almost 30 years.
Quite often what it looked like would be deputies were responding to someone who's in crisis. If there was weapons involved, they would take that opportunity to secure those weapons and take them with us.
Indiana's red flag law was passed in 2005 and is one of the oldest in the country after Connecticut, which passed its law in 1999. But it isn't used a lot. Evansville police say this may be the first time for their department. Preston says he saw the sheriff's office use it about a half dozen times.
I don't think anyone wants to live in a country where people can have their weapons seized and taken away from them.
Preston calls himself a Second Amendment supporter and says the law strikes a good balance.
We also do have to protect the public, and just because someone in a moment in time may not be healthy enough for them to have a weapon doesn't mean that down the road that they won't be able to.
The red flag law doesn't require officers to obtain a warrant, but without one, police have to get a judge's permission to hold onto the weapons. Preston says judges almost always rule in favor of law enforcement, but the gun owner can ask the court every 6 months to get the guns back.
Suicidal crises most of the time last a very short time.
Kent Leslie works at a community health clinic. He's taught classes on mental health issues to law enforcement, medical professionals, and the general community that included training to prevent suicide by limiting access to guns. It boils down to this.
When somebody's at risk of dying by suicide, if we have some distance and time from the lethal means, it does save lives.
Leslie stresses that the vast majority of people with mental illnesses are not violent. In fact, they are much more likely to be the victim of violence than to perpetrate it. He says that law enforcement is part of the larger network of family, friends, and healthcare professionals working to prevent harm.
I see the person that has a mental illness or that may be at risk of dying by suicide as the center of a wagon wheel. And those spokes that surround that wagon wheel can help that person move forward. The more spokes, the better.
Leslie says that more than half of suicides in the United States involve a gun, and red flag laws can help. Even in a red state like Indiana, which hosted the NRA convention this year, laws like these enjoy bipartisan support.
It's common sense. We don't want dangerous individuals having access to guns. And if they do, we want to make sure that we find help for these individuals and that those weapons are taken away from them.
That's Republican State Representative Wendy McNamara. This year, she co-sponsored some changes to the Indiana law, and they passed almost unanimously. The new version allows state police to give the FBI the names of people who've had their guns taken away. And it's now a crime to supply a gun to those people. The changes come as other states turn to Indiana for guidance, says McNamara.
Indiana has been recognized because we were one of the originals having a red flag law. So a lot of people are looking to Indiana as they go and rewrite a lot of their laws on this type of process when it comes to taking away weapons from dangerous individuals.
Back in Evansville, a judge allowed police to keep the guns of the man who made the threatening 911 call. His case on the 911 call is still pending, and his lawyers didn't respond to a request for comment. Evansville police say in this case, the law worked just as it was meant to. For Here and Now, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
And there is another criminal justice story we're tracking today, this one in Sweden, where the American rapper A$AP Rocky was convicted today on assault charges for his role in a street brawl back in June. The musician's case prompted a diplomatic spat between the U.S. and Sweden earlier in the summer when President Trump called for the rapper's release, vouched for his bail, and criticized the Swedish prime minister for refusing to intervene. Now the case has come to a close, the court rejecting A$AP Rocky's claim that he and two of his bodyguards were acting in self-defense when they attacked a man on a street in Stockholm. The rapper was ordered to pay a fine. He'll not face prison time. He returned to the U.S. when his trial ended on August 2nd. And A$AP Rocky, whose legal name is Rakim Mayers, says he believes he was treated unfairly because he's black. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.